Welcome to the Building PA Podcast, the voice of the construction industry throughout Pennsylvania. Here are your co-hosts, Chris Martin and John O'Brien.
Hello, and welcome to the Building PA Podcast. I am co-host John O'Brien from the Keystone Contractors Association, coming to you from good old central Pennsylvania. I'm not lonely today because we have a great guest, and I'm joined as always by co-host extraordinaire Chris Martin. Chris, what's going on today?
Hey, I love it when you introduce me. You make me feel so much better about myself. Thank you so much, man. What a great friendship, great partnership, and great co-host. Hey, everyone.
Shirt. I got a new shirt on.
It is a nice shirt. It is a nice shirt, man. That's impressive, man. It looks like you're going to the beach. I like it.
Yeah, thanks.
Good. Yeah.
Well, hey, everyone. That's why I have a daughter. My daughter got me this one, so it's all good. They have good taste.
She's got good taste. She's got good taste.
Shut up now. Introduce yourself. All right.
All right. There we go. Yeah. Hey, everybody. I'm Chris Martin. As John said, I am co-host with John, the Building PA Podcast, and I also am president and owner of Atlas Marketing, where we tell stories for companies that build things. And we've got a really cool story to tell today because this is part of our sponsorship series with Shikun & Binoy USA. We're talking about fleet electrification, and we have the man who knows all about this.
Yes.
Hagai Dror. Drum roll, please, for Hagai Dror of Shikun & Binoy. And Hagai's going to talk to us about fleet electrification. That's just not a word that flows off your tongue, but we're going to get it really finalized here, moving things forward. So Hagai, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's great.
This is exciting. Yeah.
Yeah. This is actually our first conversation around anything with electric vehicles and this part of the infrastructure and construction. So I'm excited about this. This is pretty cool. Yeah. So Hagai, help us out. Help us understand what fleet electrification is and what it means for community as a whole.
Sure. We can start from the basics. And the basics are pretty simple. It's basically the process of converting your traditional vehicles, what we call ICE, internal combustion engines, and turn them into electric vehicles. We can talk about reasons to do that, of course. But when we talk about fleet electrification, this is what we're talking about. And there's many ways to go about it. But maybe the first important thing to emphasize, and this is why fleet electrification is more than just going to your dealer and get a new vehicle. There is two things about it. One is obviously it changes the way you consume energy for your fleet. For about 100 years, even more, we've been used to run our vehicles on gasoline and diesel. And there was a very clear and simple word on how you go and get this into your vehicle. And obviously now we're talking about powering your vehicle by electricity, which is something we obviously know and use throughout most of the day, but obviously we're not used to put it in our car and we're not used to this specific technology. So this is the first thing, obviously, we need to notice. And because this is the case, and we've been seeing it a lot, is it basically creates a bundle between the vehicle you run and the energy you consume. If in the past we got used to the fact that we go and get our vehicle from Ford or Chevy or Toyota or whoever, and then we get our gasoline from Shell, that would not necessarily be the case. We see this, the one very obvious example is Tesla, which Tesla did it probably by need, but Tesla turned himself into an operator of fast chargers along main roads and in main locations. Because Tesla basically realized that if they're going to try to sell their cars, which are obviously very good cars, I'm sure everybody already heard a lot of good things about them, and basically going to tell everybody, figure out where you get electricity, it ain't going to be that easy. I'm not sure if our audience is as aware of what exactly do you need to charge your car, but just to put it in simple and high-level terms, you can charge your car, when you talk about your private vehicle at home, in a simple manner, just connecting it to a 110 plug in your garage or on a cable that you pull from your home. You get typically an adapter with the car and it charges the car. But there's two problems with that. One, it's pretty slow. And even if you leave your car overnight, again, depending on how much mileage you put on it during the day, but that might not be enough for you. And the other thing is obviously what happens if you run out of battery when you hit the road. So this is why Tesla had to go and build all those charging stations in many locations, and it really helped them to bolster their sales and to become as successful as they are. We already see this connection. Tesla is obviously first and foremost a car manufacturer, but then we see that they also become a supplier of energy, or at least a reseller or a retailer of energy, in lack of better. And when we start thinking about operating a fleet, that becomes even more complicated, and the connection between the two becomes even more clear. Because one, most fleets cannot just tell their employees, yeah, just take your vehicle overnight and charge it. And the other thing is that we're also talking about very different needs. You need special cars. You need to run a very long range throughout the day. And the cost of energy when what you do all day is just spinning your wheels all around is something very significant. So when we talk about fleet electrification, which is something we at Chikun are doing, we're really talking about working with the client, giving the full package from finding the vehicles that meet its needs, make sure it really meet the needs, including in stress scenarios, and then really helping him understand how he will be able to charge those vehicles. Obviously, fleets typically has the benefit that they have a central location, like a depot that the vehicle goes back to at the end of the day, typically, sometimes even in the middle of the day. So you can plan your charging strategy and schedule, and really how you retrofit yourself into this operation, including all aspects. We are not OEM, we don't sell vehicles, obviously, but we are able to work with many suppliers to provide relevant vehicles. And in terms of providing the entire technology that will basically allow this depot to support electrification, which is everything related to charging, basically, and providing the needed energy for the best possible cost, those are things that we can do soup to nuts.
So Tesla is the top producer, right, for electric cars?
Yeah.
I'm going to show my very basic knowledge here. So Tesla's the top. Who are some of the top manufacturers?
So it's a good question. Obviously, Tesla has been extremely dominant. Their market share has been over 80%. They've been early in the game, and they really made a big breakthrough and really showed everybody that it's possible. But the interesting thing is that almost any traditional OEM, plus some other startups or newcomers that try to do what Tesla is doing in different niches, almost everybody is playing in this game today. So if we look at let's call it the traditional OEM markets, the GMs, the Fords, the Toyotas of the world, everybody already has some electric models, some more than others, some have been more successful than others. And like I said, you have Rivian, you have Lucid, you have a bunch of others that are kind of trying to build their own kind of Tesla. And the market is pretty fragmented. I think the Tesla market share, it depends how you measure it, but it's starting to fall from 80% towards, I would say, the 50% mark. But then when you look at the rest of the pie, it's split between really a lot of operators, both traditional and new ones. When we talk about fleets, obviously some fleets can use a Tesla or, I don't know, a Mustang Mach-E or something like that, like a small vehicle. But we typically, when we look at fleets, we look at pickup trucks, we look at vans, buses, stuff like that. When you look at those markets, the competition is more limited. It's basically limited to the traditional players that focus on this field, that's been producing, let's say, school buses in the past. There is three main producers active in the US today. They're all started producing electric models. And again, like in probably everywhere you look in this industry, there is a bunch of startups that develop their own model, and maybe they'll make it, maybe they won't.
Yeah. And in a follow-up with all these different manufacturers, is the charging universal? Because nothing's worse than an iPhone, and you get the wrong charger. And
yeah, and it's funny. A lot of people look at when you look at this case study. So Tesla is a lot like Apple, and all the rest are a lot like the Android ecosystem, but with one big difference, probably. So standardization was indeed a big issue across the industry, and for the most part, in the last, let's say, 5 years, when this really started to become a thing, Tesla ran their own protocol. Part of it was intentional because Tesla, and it's still the case, although they already announced it would change, Tesla designates their charging, the public charging stations, only to Tesla owners. So they brand their own connection and their own standard. But two interesting things happened since. One is that all the rest managed to agree on a protocol which kind of standardized how you do fast charging. And the other thing that happened is that actually a lot of the Android quote-unquote players are actually adopting the Apple or Tesla standard now. And my guess, it's a bit too early to say, but I think we're going to see most of the industry shifting to the Tesla protocol. We're getting there, is the short answer.
Slowly but surely, right?
Yeah.
Hagai, you mentioned something that was interesting earlier, which I never thought of, but it's the charging strategy for a fleet. So let's talk about what does that mean for your clients and what you're working in, or not what, but who you're working with, because you had mentioned school buses as an example, and I know there's other examples that you had given us, like Amazon or UPS deliveries and those type of things. But can you talk a little bit about what that means for the future of more of the fleet versus the personal side?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's two main things that you look at. One, maybe it's important to provide this context, especially when we look at heavy vehicles. If you don't pick the right strategy and if you don't have the right technology, you might run out of range during the day. And we definitely don't want this to happen, right? We want to have at least some kind of a fallback. But this is not something that typically happens when you run your traditional ICE vehicles. And even if it does, you can always go and stop in Sheets if you're here in Pennsylvania and just fuel your tank. So one thing is you want to make sure you're not running out of range. The other thing, which is also related to range, but from a different angle, is you want to make sure you have enough time to charge the vehicle during its downtime with the proper technology. So you want to plan when this charging happens. Obviously, the most common strategy is to do it overnight when the vehicle is not active, as this is a vehicle that is active during the day. But the other thing that factors into that, and a lot of people are still rightfully so struggling to wrap their heads around, there is also a significant, when we talk about charging vehicles, especially charging a fleet of trucks, this is a significant amount of energy, same way as it's a significant amount of fuel that goes into school buses today, but with one very big difference. Fuel is going to cost you the same no matter when you pump it into your vehicle, right? It might be a little different if you buy from a different vendor, or if you use different sourcing strategies, but by and large, once you have your vendor, the price is the price. When we talk about electricity, there is a lot of things you can do if you are flexible and smart about how you manage your charging to reduce your cost. And that's where it comes to clients that we're working with that are willing to do a bit more complicated projects that can also be much more beneficial. And for example, you can do some things like not just having a simple charging network that basically pulls electricity from the grid and pumps it into the vehicle, whatever you're looking for, but you can actually build some sort of independent network for yourself. It's typically called microgrid is a professional term. It can be based on a battery that, you know, you can fill when battery is cheap to acquire and then basically offload it at the appropriate time. And the other way to do it is with a small solar facility or any other kind of generation strategy. But the interesting thing about it is that it really turns you into someone that can be independent and how he manages his energy. And you can produce your own energy for your fleet and have a much better control in terms of how much you're paying and how much benefit you can get out of it.
So that's really the goal, is to have that independence, right? And that's why companies are coming to you and your colleagues at Chacon and Benoy to really understand how that independence becomes an opportunity, right?
Exactly. And obviously, in that case, we're looking not just at the charging strategy, but basically to energy strategy for the company. In this facility that you have your depot, what other power users do you have? And even if you don't have power users, are there clients that you can actually offer this energy to them? Let's say if we install such a microgrid, and either we manage it or the client manage it. Maybe there's people around you that have this opportunity to buy electricity from you, which is going to be cheaper than what they pay off the grid. And that again ties into this, when is it that you charge your vehicles? When can you produce electricity? And now you can manage this load. It sounds like a very weird concept to most people, because we've been used to the fact that we just paid UK Light or First Energy or whatever and just get the electricity and they charge us whatever they charge us. But it's actually a fascinating market with a lot of opportunities. We always encourage clients, even if they think they don't have the use profile for that, we always encourage them to analyze this partner, because in many cases you find a very surprising business case.
So are you, with all the clients and all the companies that you talk to, do you have any sort of examples that, like, maybe surprise benefits that they didn't anticipate, or maybe on the negative side, surprise lessons learned that popped up?
Yes. So obviously the big thing is that you need scale. And a lot of people can shy off doing a large scale project, especially now because this industry is still taking some baby steps at this stage. But I think maybe the most surprising factor to a lot of people as to what we do in Shikun is that we can really provide financing solutions that really help people to smooth this large upfront expense. Because this is another important aspect. Even if you're just replacing the vehicles and put charging infrastructure in place, let alone if you're doing a microgrid and you do a much more complex project, this is a big upfront investment that only pays itself back over time, right? You're going to pay a little more for the vehicle. You're going to pay, obviously, extra to put the charging infrastructure in place. And then the benefit obviously will come over time from cost savings on energy, which are very significant. And I think a lot of clients are surprised when we tell them that we can do it all for you. We can actually front you all this money and basically do it in a seamless way to you, that you're going to pay us a monthly fee that already gets everything together, and you're going to get all the benefits by just lowering your monthly cost. So I think that's the biggest surprise we may be encountering. Another thing, I don't know if it's exactly the same thing, but I find it interesting is, you know, that especially, let's say, when we talk about school buses, but even when we talk about last mile delivery vehicles, or even trucks that we're giving to some of our employees as part of a program we're doing now in-house, is how much the users love the product, the electric vehicles. It's not just a feel-good kind of thing. Obviously, there is this aspect. They're actually a pleasure to drive and pleasure to be a passenger on. If you talk about the school bus, it's so quiet, it's so clear. Parents absolutely love that. But even when we talk about professional drivers, a lot of them are saying, yeah, I'm not coming back. It's so quiet. It has so much power and torque, and they just love it. So we find that those that try it, they fall in love and they stick with it.
I never thought of the quietness.
Yeah. I remember all the school bus rides I had long time ago, man. It was like, you'd hear the guy grinding the gears and all that fun stuff. So I get that. That makes sense. But the one thing that you just mentioned though, too, that I think is really interesting is that financing component. Yeah. Because Shikun & Binoy is based in, I'm not 100% sure, but in the Middle East somewhere, right? In Israel, correct?
Yeah.
So bringing this, a different mentality or a different approach to how you manage a project like this, or at least get it started, is intriguing. Could you talk a little bit about that? Because I know that's one that really, as Americans, we don't really consider or even look at.
The P3 concept, which we've been doing for 35 years, more or less now around the world, it's basically a concept in which government entities that want to procure a project or a service basically get into a contract with a company that is able to deliver it, what you call it, a developer. And the developer will basically sign some sort of a project agreement, which will hand him the responsibility to do that. Let's say we build a new toll road, is the case in a lot of this project, or in this case, we build a bus depot for a company or for a government entity. And basically, instead of the client paying us during construction by milestone payment or whatever, in typical construction, we basically defer the payment for as long as 30, it can be even 50 years, depends on the project. And basically, we take this entire package and we find a way to finance it. We basically find a way to bridge this gap that the client might not necessarily have the money to pay us today for the whole thing, but will be able to pay it over decades with some interest. In many ways, it's very similar to the way we buy a house, right? Which is very common to every American, to almost every person around the world. Not a lot of us can afford to buy the house cash. We use this method that we just pay a small portion and then the rest, the bank is banking us and allowing us to pay over time. So we step into this position and do that. And in the U.S. space, those kinds of projects, they've been in existence, but we see it developing a lot slower than you might have expected. This model really started from the U.K. from as far as 150 years back. Went from there to most of the Commonwealth. It's pretty common in Canada, in Australia. From there, it went to Europe, eventually got to Israel as well. And the US really started adopting this model, let's say, 15 years ago, relatively slowly. And we're still finding ourselves pitching it and with more and more success. I haven't mentioned that because it's not related to fleet electrification, but we've been very successful in doing very large projects by this model in the US. But the one other big thing about it is that it's more than just a financing mechanism when you bundle the project like that. Because a lot of US entities are opening brackets and talking a little bit why the model has been a bit slower to infiltrate into the US market. A lot of entities say, we're okay with financing. The US government entities has been very good with municipal bonds and like those mechanisms that basically allow them to procure stuff, even if they can only pay for them over 30 years and not cash. But the real other aspect of P3 is that this developer, other than the fact that he's giving you financing, is basically tying himself to this project and tying himself to the success of this project, which becomes super critical when we talk about fleet electrification, that you need to bring together the actual rolling stock, the bus or the vehicle that you bring in. You need to bring in the charging infrastructure. You need to take care of energy. And, oh, by the way, you want to make sure that everything still works after 20 or 30 years in operation. And because of the way it's structured, we have so much skin in the game that we basically take ourselves the commitment that everything will work perfectly and seamlessly. Because otherwise, the client can just hold our money and say, look, you're not providing me the service anymore. So other than the fact that it's a brilliant financing mechanism that typically can be as cheap as government rates of financing, it's also a great method to get certainty of delivery and to make sure that you get all the components together. And we find this model awesome for fleet electrification because of all the uncertainties that you have here.
Yeah. I didn't even take into account maintenance. And that's a whole nother ball game there. That's a whole nother interview process here.
That's another piece of what we're doing.
Yeah. Interesting.
Can I ask this question, Hervé? When you're talking to a company about, let's say, a fleet for that last mile delivery, are you recommending to your clients to just go out and buy new electrical vans, or are you helping them convert them from the ICE material to more of an electrical system?
Yes, lawyer answer is that it depends, but there is actually a more simple answer. So typically you go and you buy a new vehicle and you better off, especially when you talk about the van space. One caveat to that, in the school bus space, it's not very dominant yet, but it might be in the future. When you talk about school buses, there have been some projects, and from a technological perspective, it works, that you can take a traditional school bus, an ICE bus, and basically replace it. You install the battery at the bottom of the bus. This is why it works, because you have enough room to do it, and obviously change the engine systems and stuff like that. So we did start to see a little bit of those kinds of projects. And I think that in some cases, the more that the market will mature, we will start seeing some people doing that. But for the most part, it typically involves going and acquiring the new vehicles.
That's interesting, especially I can imagine, as you mentioned before, the Teslas, the Toyota, every major car manufacturer has their own electrical vehicle, or at least is planning to come out in the next year with an electric vehicle. But I can't imagine there's a lot of electric vans or electric school buses. So being able to convert those over, unfortunately, it adds more time to the project, right? But it also adds some complexity, which is interesting to have somebody like yourselves that had gone through it and understand how to do it and can help make that a reality. So that's a cool way to add to that.
Yeah. We brought up school buses quite a few times here during this interview. And when I think of school buses, I think of public schools and buses going down the roadways. Speaking of that, is there anything that we might not consider or might not be thinking about when it comes to public and policy? Anything besides like financing? Is there any other roadblocks or anything holding this back?
Yeah. So when we talk about school buses, one big thing that dictates the ability to provide good service will be geography and weather. Obviously, we know it from ICE vehicles, but obviously very hilly kind of school districts and stuff like that can have bigger energy consumptions. And when we talk about the battery that can, you know, a bus that can run out of range, that can be an issue. Do you see from our analysis and from clients we work with, we do see that those buses will be enough for, I would say, 99% of the school buses in the US as they are today. Probably in 2-3 years when technology will advance, it will be even, it will fit 100%, but still there might be some districts that the city or the district or whoever runs the buses will not feel comfortable to deploy the bus to. And the other obviously is weather considerations. Because we do see some degradation in battery performance in cold weather. Again, it's not anything catastrophical, but you don't want to lose 20% when your range is already at its limit. I don't think it's dominant enough, but I do see it plays out like that, that once buses will start being deployed, I think there's going to be some equity considerations. And I think that some people, some politicians and people like that rightfully would want to avoid a conversation of, oh, why did you give this school all these new shiny buses and we still ride the old crappy bus? It's the difference is very evident. I think we haven't seen it much yet, but when people will start saying the kids traveling the electric one rather than the traditional one, you will see that it's almost like comparing a Ferrari to a Mazda. So I think there's going to be some enviness and some politics to be managed around it. That's definitely something to be mindful
of. That honestly is something that I don't think I would have even considered. Like that fear of missing out or what about me type of thing. But at that point, you're getting adopted and that educational component is breaking through. So that's probably a positive there.
Yeah.
Wow. Interesting. Guy, I want to thank you for joining us today. This has been a very enlightening conversation. And again, for everyone, this is part of our Shikun & Binoy Electric Vehicle and Infrastructure Series. We'll have some more topics coming up in the future where we're talking more of infrastructure needs and the like. But Guy, thank you so much. Can't wait to continue the conversation.
I'm good. Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for joining the Building PA Podcast. To stay up to date, follow us on LinkedIn and Facebook, and visit buildingpapodcast.com to subscribe to upcoming shows. Thanks for listening.